Welcome to the LRM podcast, sponsored by Adrian Flux Insurance. I'm Steve Miller, and you'll notice that this is not Martin doing the introduction, because sitting next to me, we have a guest. Not just any guest, but we have Patrick Crowagon. And regular readers of the magazine will know that Patrick actually was our old editor before Martin. So welcome, Pat.
Gee, Steve, it's such an honour to be here. It's been 2 years since I was at the helm of the magazine, and it's nice to come back and take part in what is probably the fastest growing Land Rover podcast in the world.
Absolutely. Yeah, we are. We're tracking quite well on the leagues at the moment, with thanks to all our listeners. So, yeah, I can't believe it's been 2 years since we've not worked together.
Exactly. I obviously heard about your podcast several months ago, and I'll be honest, I didn't listen to it initially, but now, when I get in the car and I take Isaac to school, it comes on, and I really enjoyed the recent one you did with Neil Watterson. The man is just a wealth of knowledge when it comes to technical stuff about Land Rovers, which is obviously not my field of expertise, as we well know. But I definitely think you're onto a good thing here.
Yeah, it's been quite a journey, really, because we went from launching this podcast, 6-7 months ago, and it's a weekly thing. So we're trying to break it up with no one wants to necessarily listen to me and Martin Rabbit on week after week. So we do like to introduce some guests. And we work together. We've known each other, what now, 12, 13 years? Feels longer. So anyone that hasn't been regular listeners or readers of the magazine. So Pat, you joined the magazine, it's got to be 12 years ago.
Yeah, so it's a little bit more than that. I spent 10 years at the magazine, and how I got involved in the magazine is quite an interesting story in itself. And if you don't mind, I'll share that with the listeners. It was literally, I'd moved to the UK, and as someone from South Africa, you know about Land Rover Monthly, you know about Land Rover owners, you dream of these magazines because you live miles and miles away on another continent. And arriving in the UK, I didn't have a job, initially living in Northern Ireland, and started seeing what is out there in the magazine industry. And my wife at the time, she saw an advert for a job at LRM, and I literally jumped out. I didn't like the cold and the wet of Belfast, jumped on a plane to Birmingham and knocked on the door of the offices at Wollaston and said, hello, I hear you're looking for someone.
I remember that day, because we were, our old offices were in a lovely, weren't they, barn conversion, like complex, along with Octane magazine and Evo magazine. And I think we were going out for somebody's birthday. Sounds like we were at the pub all the time, but we went to the pub. And I remember walking out of the door. I said to Dave Lillywhite, who was the editor of Octane, I said, who's that chap sitting there in the LRM editorial seat? He goes, oh, I don't know. What do you mean you don't know? Is he all right? It was just, you were doing some paperwork. You were applying for the job.
Yeah.
But they're officially in the seat that you then took.
So
such a random.
I know, we had phoned the magazine, and I said, I'm coming to see you and to have a little chat. And obviously the chat went really well. It was Dave Lillywhite and Dave Phillips, who was the then editor of the magazine. But then they said to me, just, whoa, we you have to actually apply for the job. You have to go through the personnel.
And, proper channel.
Yeah, yeah. And so I eventually did that. And then I had to come back and do another interview. And I had to edit a piece of work. And I think I remember I put on a jacket and tie for that final interview. And straight away, they offered me the job. It was almost like it was meant to be. And sort of prior to that, I edited another magazine also for 10 years. So it was, I feel very blessed to have, not long after arriving in the UK, to land this really great job.
Well, yeah, absolutely. I mean, those jobs, I mean, back then there would be a queue of people for the position. So to get, I mean, the job at the time wasn't to edit LRM, was it? It was it features editor or something?
Just as a basic junior journalist,
yeah.
Really. It wasn't no great shakes. But I mean, as a junior journalist at a major Land Rover magazine, you're going to be going green laning, you hopefully go in the art car launch and get out of the office and do the product section of the magazine that everybody so loves. So I just as I said, I felt so blessed.
Yeah, and that was good times. And obviously we used to do your legendary barbecues or braais, as you'd call them. our lunch times.
Yeah, so I didn't live too far away from the office, whereas some people were driving from Peterborough, for the old EMAP staff were driving quite a long way to get there. But I think I had a Ford Escort at the time.
Oh, yeah, I remember.
Maroon Ford. I didn't have a Land Rover, and I got a job at a Land Rover magazine. It was an old Ford Escort. I would drive, and obviously arriving here, you straight away buy a braai or a barbecue, and then I would bring that into the office, and sort of once a month on a Friday when the weather was good, I would cook for everyone. So you'd all be working, and I'd head out and start.
It's just fantastic, wasn't it? Those days will never, ever be repeated, will they? Like, they were the absolute golden days of publishing, I would say.
I mean, and for someone who had worked at SA4x4 magazine, a small magazine in South Africa, suddenly you've got Dave Lillywhite, Octane magazine, you've got Stu at Evo, and there were some really good top world-class journalists working at these magazines. I was just in awe. I felt like the token African in the office. So it was a great way to learn. People like Dave Lillywhite, Dave Phillips, these are good journalists, and they really taught me a lot. And I think things went really well after that. Yeah,
yeah, you needed to kind of find your feet, didn't you? And one of the stories I recall is, because obviously you'd come from South Africa, and you've pretty much, we'll talk about this in a minute, about your way you've travelled in Land Rovers and pretty much a lot of countries, haven't you? But you asked the question, you made a bit of a mistake, didn't you? And you asked the question on a UK forum, where's the most aggressive green lane in the country?
Yeah.
And you got like...
The toughest
or something, yeah, wasn't it? And loads of people sort of came out of the woodworks and, you can't do that. Because we're quite protective of green lanes in the UK. You're just thinking it's the outback, or
yes,
it's driving from one desert to another. But you soon discovered the UK was kind of quite precious about green laning and responsibility.
Yeah, I quickly learned it was a very different market and different sort of setting when it came to overlanding and off-roading to South Africa. And you had to be sensitive to, you couldn't post an image of a vehicle sort of plowing through mud or mud flying, and people were just saying, you don't have to drive that way. And you're right, you probably don't have to, but sometimes you need a bit of oomph or you need to slam down that accelerator to get through something that's quite technical. I quickly learned that there were certain things that were frowned upon on the Mud Island, which were maybe accepted or you could get away with in the outback of Australia.
So going back then, so I remember that you had your Ford Escort and you were quite keen, weren't you, to buy your first Land Rover in the UK. And I remember we didn't really know each other. We were finding our feet, weren't
we?
Because I was like sales exec or something at the time, and Gemma, who was a sales manager, and we were all finding our
different
feet.
Offices.
Yeah. We were sort of in the same building, weren't we, but different offices. And you walked in one day and you said, I've just made a bid on a Land Rover, and I saved you that day. Do you remember the Land Rover you bid on eBay?
Yeah, it was horrible.
It was the worst Land Rover. If there's anyone out there, right, it was multicolored.
Yeah.
It had like a base box in the back. And like, Series 3 it was, wasn't it? Checker plate everywhere.
It was a bit so.
2.25 diesel or something.
I'd obviously just moved to the UK and I had sold my Defender 90, which was really nicely kitted out in South Africa. I left that behind and I thought, you can't work at a Land Rover magazine and not drive. And I wanted something Defender-like. I didn't want a Freelander or a Discovery. I mean, in hindsight, I should have probably got a Discovery 2 or Discovery 1, which are more... it was not long before my son was born, so you'd probably have something that's family-friendly. But I eventually went and bought a TDI Defender, a 110. But
Because I found you that.
Yeah.
Remember?
It was cheap. It was,
really cheap.
Yeah.
It wasn't cheap at the time. It was about the right money, but it's cheap now.
$2,000 or $3,000, I think.
Yeah, I think I remember right. So I think
sold it for really $5,000 a year later. So it was.
Yeah.
It was cheap.
You had to do a bit, didn't you?
Yeah.
I remember driving through this village. And there was the white 110 hardtop with windows in the side for sale at the side of the road for $2,350, I think it was up for.
Yeah.
I think you got it for $2,750.
Yeah.
It was an early 200, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
And I remember, you did quite a lot of work to it.
Jeez, I put a jump seat in the back for Isaac, front seats, Melbourne, new seat covers.
Better wheels and tires.
Better wheel and tire suspension. We did loads of work to it. I think it even got it. Did I get a winch? I'm not sure. I think I might have got a winch at the end.
I think you did,
I did get a winch. And then I sold it, sadly. But by then, I had already had my eyes on a Defender in South Africa that I wanted to buy and bring back to the UK. So I found a Defender there for £4,000, which is nothing. A 110.
You're missing a vehicle out.
I am.
Is that a Deliverer?
I hope Ed Evans doesn't listen to you.
Yeah, but so he had a Discovery 2, didn't he? Yeah, love. But again, Discovery 2s at the time were known for rotting, but they weren't at that age where they were all rotten.
Yeah.
I'm not saying all Discovery 2s were rotten, but they're known for rear chassis, and that certainly needed some welding, didn't it?
And it was sort of rewind a bit. When Discovery 2s were used in the first ever G4 Challenge, the second leg or third leg was held in South Africa. And I got driven around for a whole week in a Discovery 2. And I thought, geez, this car is wonderful. And as I said, Sun was born then, and I needed something with a bit more comfort and a bit more sort of highway friendly. And that's why I decided to go for Discovery 2. And if you're going to buy from anyone, why not buy from the technical editor of LRA? Because this vehicle is going to be good. And so I bought this lovely D2 from BU51 VEL was the reg. I bought that from Ed, and it didn't last that long.
But again, it was one of those where, you know, the chassis soon take hold there.
I think it was busy launching boats in the Lake District.
Possibly. It definitely seen some salt water in the back half of the chassis.
Yeah. And so I thought the chassis was a lot better, and it needed re-chassing after a few months that I had it. It wasn't going to pass an MOT. And so then there was that whole debate. Do you buy a chassis? Do you spend $4,000 or $5,000 putting a new chassis in and holding onto it because it's such a valuable vehicle that TD5 engines are great?
Yeah, yeah.
Or do you just go and buy a Defender for $4,000 in South Africa and ship it over? So that was the option or the route I decided to go. And it went to a good home. Trevor, one of our technical writers in Ireland, who Mr. D2 chassis, he purchased it, re-chassied it, sold to a friend. So at least it went to a good home. It got given another lease on life by having the chassis replaced. Yeah,
I remember because D2 chassis had only just come out then. You couldn't get one. I think Richard Chassis was the first to bring one to the market. Yeah. And yeah, the cost even then was like, this is a big ask. But then, so then your Defender 110 called the Green Mamba.
Yeah.
So anyone that's followed you on your Instagram, which is at Bush Editor.
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah. Yep.
So anyone that wants to check, you'll still have pictures on there. But I remember you said to me once, I bought this Land Rover and it's coming over in a shipping container. Do you want to help me get it? I said, yeah, okay. So we drove down there in my Discovery 1, didn't we? And we borrowed a trailer from Rogers of Bedford.
Yeah, yeah.
And
hot day.
The hottest day of the year. So we drove down the M25. Where was that docks? Around the M25.
Yeah, it's outside London. It's the London docks where the sort of Thames is flowing towards the ocean. It was just off the M25.
Yeah. So we drove down, didn't we? And, yeah. I said, yeah, I'll give you a hand. I have never, to this day, towed anything with a Land Rover so heavy. Is that?
Yeah.
So we got it out of the, that was quite exciting, wasn't it? When you first opened the container. And there was.
Yeah.
There was two in there, wasn't there?
There was. My friend from Gateway in Wellington, South Africa, he had sent two over. The other one went to Paul at, it also went to Rogers, but it went to Paul Wells. He boarded quite a rare Defender at the time. It was a Defender 90. It was one of only 24, 25 50th anniversary South African Defender 90s. But it was the wrong color. The guy had repainted from Santorini blue to red. I think it was a Welsh guy that was living in Cape Town. He did that to it. So Paul was going to get it back to looking like it did originally. So there were those two Defenders waiting for us in the docks. But you're right, opening the container doors and seeing your vehicle there. And I keep on saying what I paid for it, but I often don't tell people. I probably spent the same on it. We had a lot of work done to it in South Africa just to make it look really good. But obviously the labor there was cheaper. So, I mean, I can show you 3 pages of the job list that had been work that had been done to it. Yeah.
So anyone that's not familiar with the South African Land Rovers, they came with a 2.8
M52
engine.
BMW petrol engine, straight six petrol engine, yeah.
Which is quite, I mean, they are rare in the UK.
I mean, they only produced, say, 1,400 of them.
Yeah.
But, I mean, there's quite a few in the UK. Rogers of Bedford, they imported a few sort of in the early 2000s. So they were known as the UK dealership that knew how to work on them. So there are a few floating about there. Now that those vehicles are more than 25 years old, a lot of them are going to the US. I mean, someone phoned me last week. He's having problems getting one into the UK. It's sitting at the docks. Okay. So I was trying to help a guy with some paperwork for that. So there are, I would say, there are probably not more than 20 or 30 of them maybe in the UK at most. As I said, they only made 1,400. But my friend Ollie, a racing driver, he's got two.
I remember because we featured him in the
magazine. Yeah, he was on the cover of the magazine. Yeah. So he's got a little 90, but he's his a 50th anniversary one. He's got a 90, but then he recently bought in a 110, which is done beautifully and definitely worth a feature in the magazine. He's just finished rebuilding a 110. It's not original, but it's got the engine in, and he's done some lovely stuff to it as a racing driver. I think you'd like.
Yeah, no, we should have a look. I mean, your Land Rover, when I first drove it, I felt it was very low geared.
It was
very revvy engine, a 2.8, but in a BMW car, it's a great engine.
Yeah,
I always felt they were really revvy and not ass talky, so you had to really drive them through the gears, which inevitably guzzles fuel.
Yeah, because our offices, we moved from Wollaston down to the Bedford near the Autodrome, and when the vehicle first arrived, the guys from Evo magazine were obviously very interested in this because they do performance cars. So I remember one of their journalists taking it around for a quick drive, and he's like, wow, this is one of the most unique Defenders I've ever driven. And that was the attraction. That's what I owned in South Africa, because it was obviously it used a lot of fuel. And
a lot. Yeah. You were probably down to what, late teens, 20 to the gallon, yeah. You think?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Definitely 20. Yeah.
On a band. With the wind around you.
Yeah, 20 or less, yeah. So, yeah, it wasn't great with fuel. I mean, it had an extra fuel tank in. So that gives you an indication of how much fuel we're using. So you'd throw in 100 litres, and if you're doing a lot of driving, maybe a week and a half later, you're having to.
So. I mean, we were at a time where, you weighing that, but fuel in the UK was at £2 a litre. And when you're, £8, £9 a gallon, and you're doing 20 miles, it's almost getting on to 50p a month.
Yeah, I was talking to someone about it yesterday, and obviously now I've got another petrol vehicle, but it's not a Land Rover. But I still took it to France. We went and drove in the dunes there. I didn't not go to places, but I definitely did think about the consumption. And at the time when I was editor of the magazine, you would be getting press cars all the time, and you're rather going to take a press car than a N52 engine Defender on a trip, just because it's more sort of cost efficient.
So I remember we could claim our mileage, couldn't we, at 40p a mile, and I remember saying to you, do you know what, Pat, every mile you drive you're losing 10p, because that's supposed to like cover the wear and tear, insurance contribution, everything else. It was like, it's costing you 10p every time you do a mile for the
bag. But the lovely thing is but when I decided to sell it, when I went to go and work at Frontrunner, it's gone to a really good home in the US. It's a Defender importer purchased it, and I sold it for four times what I paid for it.
Yeah.
And this guy, he didn't just buy it to sell it to someone in the US. He's done an amazing job of sorting it out. He spent a lot of money on it. Still got the original paintwork with the original scratches that I received from the previous owner, and he drives his kids to school in it.
Oh wow.
And he's using it and he loves it. So it's gone to a good Land Rover home. And it's funny though, when we sell our Land Rovers, that's one of the things we like to do. We just want to sell it to any old dick.
They're not just any old car, are they?
Yeah.
Like, you probably haven't given your Ford Escort, your first UK car, a 74.
No.
Probably the first time you've mentioned it in 15 years.
I know.
And yet Land Rovers get under your skin, which is why many of our, listeners
it's probably gone to a better home.
Yeah. I mean, I remember when it first came in, and we put it on a trailer, didn't we? And I towed it with my 300 TDI Discovery.
Yeah.
What I didn't tell you, and what is that, 2 weeks after that, my head gasket on my 300 went. So we had to do a head gasket. Do you remember the temperature gauge or iron went straight into the red?
Yeah.
We were at, it was over 30 degrees in the UK, around the M25. We couldn't do more than about 40 miles an hour.
Yeah.
The Land Rover just wouldn't Because, yeah, his Land Rovers can tow 3.5 tons. It just wouldn't pull properly.
And it didn't have a rack on, didn't have a lot of weight. It was
just... But the ARB fund by...
Of course.
And that was a fair bit of weight.
That's a lot of weight,
Did it have some bits in the back? Can't remember some spares.
Did it have a draw system? No, it had all the seats. No, it didn't. No.
I was pleased to get it off the trailer when we got back to Bedford.
I'm sorry that I destroyed it.
No, they're fine, because my mate Pete did the head gasket in about an hour and a half. But still, it did cook the car.
Yeah,
because I had that three-door Discovery at the time. So going back to like your first Land Rover experience then, so you would have been back in South Africa.
Yeah, yeah. So when I left the military, I studied to be a journalist. I went and did a degree in journalism. And then also, very similar to the interview at LRM, it was a Monday morning, bought a newspaper, saw an advert, do you like adventure travel? And then SA 4x4 were looking for a junior journalist. And I went in there and I'd written for Men's Health and I'd done a few sort of sports types articles for magazines. And I threw these magazines on the table. And I said, please, can I get a job? And they didn't get back to me for several weeks. And eventually, I just kept on phoning them. Eventually, they just gave me the job. And within 2 years, I was editor of this magazine, SA 4x4. But I think... I'd obviously told one or two porkies in the interview about my abilities, not writing abilities, but off-road experience. Or can I say, so that literally you arrive at the office on the Monday, by that Wednesday, Thursday, they throw you the keys to a diesel Ford Ranger and say, on Saturday, you're going to go drive this trail and Sunday you're driving that trail. And you arrive there and the farmer goes, have you ever driven off-road? And you go, yeah. And then you look at him, you go, no, actually I haven't. And then, so I literally learned on the job, but when I say I learned, it was incredible. I went and did a lot of courses, off-road driving courses, technical driving courses, which was great. And then, but when you're that young, when you're sort of late 20s and you just want to drive, in South Africa, the trails were graded from 1 to 5 in the magazines, like with your green line article. So we would have, depending on the severity, and 5 is, there's a very real chance you're going to damage your vehicle. And I didn't care because we were given a Hilux by Toyota. For a couple of years, and I just took this thing on the most technical trails in South Africa because I wanted to learn and I wanted to drive. And if you smash something, you didn't care. Because no, you didn't care, but
it didn't affect you personally.
Yeah, it wasn't my kind of
testing the equipment, aren't you?
Yeah.
At the end of the day, you are pushing it to its limits,
and you have to write an honest review of that trail because people are going to be taking their own vehicles on them. So that's how I learned to off road, and it was sort of baptism by fire. But my first ever Land Rover story was the G4 challenge, and I hadn't been to the magazine for a long time, and they're like, do you want to go in the G4 challenge? And that's like the Camel Trophy.
Yeah, cool.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
And then
you're like punching the air going, wow, I've got
to, I lived
in, paid for this.
No, and I lived in Cape Town, and the leg was starting in Cape Town, the second or third leg of the first G4 challenge, and they put you up in a 5-star hotel in your own city. It's like, you feel like a rock star.
Yeah.
But things change very quickly. I'll tell you a funny story. Then they also give you a tent and a sleeping bag and a jacket. And then the rest of the week, you're camping. So after the 5-star hotel, you go straight into camping because you're following this race.
Okay.
All along what is known as the Garden Route, which is one of the most beautiful tourist areas of South Africa. It's the sort of south coast. So you're going from Cape Town to sort of George Niza. But it's beautiful. And there was this one Italian journalist, this female, and she was in high heels and beautifully dressed. And she walks out of the 5-star hotel the first day, and then they tell her she's going to be camping tonight. She just did an about turn and went back.
Wasn't for her.
No, didn't want to follow the G4 challenge. And I loved it. I was in my element. I would literally run with these athletes as they're on their bikes or running, and I would, with my camera, and I was just shooting, and I thought, this is the life. And then you get to meet people like Nick Dimbleby or Simon Day, they're from D4, the guy that used to run Camel Trophy, the Day Brothers, you know, these legends.
And, yeah, yeah.
And as a... working for a magazine, but still driving a Defender and being a Land Rover owner and enthusiast, this was heaven. And then from there, it just sort of took off after that. If I tell you about some of the Land Rover features I've been on since then, it's probably 10 or 20 of the best years of my life. You know, you just go and have so much. And then the next G4 was in Thailand and Bangkok and in Laos, which is one of the only communist countries left in the world. So couple of years later, you go on the reconnaissance and then you go on the actual event. And it's just, and you fly a business class and they fly you to these things. And it was rock star journalism. It doesn't happen anymore.
No, it's just unfortunate, isn't it? But I mean, I remember your early days in, you know, joining LRM is a case of like, you know, the publishing budgets then were somewhat different to what they are now.
Yeah.
And, you know, you would look, I remember you looking for opportunities. Where can I travel to next?
I mean,
you know, it's in a country you hadn't been to. I was like, I want to go there. What Land Rover story can I get along the way?
Yeah, I didn't just want to be an editor or Land Rover journalist. I wanted to also have these incredible experiences. So, I mean, the one weekend I flew to Moscow because there was a series Land Rover in Moscow.
I remember that. Sorry.
While I was driving around. And there's a story I'll tell you about that trip, which no one knows. But I had to go and interview the owner. It was a Scottish guy that worked for a legal firm in Moscow. And I arrived there at like 2 a.m. on a Friday. It's -30 degrees. And the same jacket I've got here now.
Yeah.
But you know, guys, jacket. They saved me a whole lot of gear for this trip. It was so cold there. And so you go out, shoot on the Red Square. We got chased off the Red Square because we quickly put the vehicle on the Red Square. I snapped the photos. The police came.
What was it? A Series 2A or something?
Yes,
something.
It was.
The guy commuted in Moscow traffic.
It was a Series 2A. He commuted every day to work from his home, his nice lush apartment, to his law offices. Every day would drive in the Moscow traffic. It's the only, I mean, there's probably one or two P38s or something, Range Rovers knocking.
But something that old. But you found him on Instagram, didn't he?
Yeah. He contacted me. And then I just booked a flight to Moscow.
Yeah,
weekend. Booked a hotel that was cheap. It was like 350 quid for a hotel and a flight. And as a South African, I have two passports. So South Africans don't need visas for Russia. I just use my South African passport. Obviously, they're very suspicious of you being African. But next thing, stamp in there, in an Uber to your hotel in -30. It was crazy. It was. And then I did this. And he took me out. After the shoot that night, took me to the finest hotel in Moscow, and about 10, 11 o'clock, he just left me in a nightclub and off he went. And then but I'd had a lot of vodka by that stage. And the next morning I was supposed to go to the Land Rover Experience Moscow. I couldn't get out of bed, knocking on my door, and I was like, no, sorry, mate, I can't.
No, can do.
Yeah. So no one knows, but I didn't do the story on Land Rover Experience I was supposed to. No one knew I was going there, but I didn't. So I went for a long run when I eventually got out of bed, and there's a beautiful park. I went ice skating in this park afterwards, and then I only flew home the Sunday night. But it was, but those sort of experiences are priceless, you know.
You just can't do it now.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah, as you said, there's not the budgets to do those sort of stories, but you can still have a hell of a lot of fun in the UK. I mean, I remember once taking a new Range Rover to Pembrokeshire and sleeping on a beach, and it was 30 degrees with my paddleboard and cooking crayfish on the beach there. That to me, that is just as much. That is living. That is. And all your readers, anyone that drives a Land Rover, you don't need a Land Rover, you know, just to go to those beautiful places. Obviously, you need the weather for it, but that to me, that's just as nice as being in the Serengeti or the Outback. Yeah.
One of the things I remember that you said to me was that you've travelled a lot in the world, mostly with work, mostly around Land Rovers. But the best trip you said you've ever been on was the North Coast 500. Is that still true?
Yeah. So,
North Coast 500 for our listeners outside of the UK is basically around Scotland.
Yeah, it's the northern part of Scotland. So, when I not long after starting at the magazine, I think 3 or 4 years in, we got a message that this new route was opening up. I mean, the roads were always there, but
yeah, the tourist board, was reinventing
a
the
very
wheel.
Clever thing.
Yeah, very, very clever.
And for me, the sort of up the western side of that route and from Applecross up, it's definitely one of the most beautiful roads I've ever driven.
Really?
It is. Just every corner you go around, it just blows you away. And you just want to stop and take it all in. And I don't think the east side is as pretty, although I've done the northeast 250 route, and I quite love that because it's not as busy as the North Coast 500. But yeah, that was a very special trip, and we were lucky because no one knew about it then. And we also, Scotland is all about timing. You don't go where there's midges, don't go when the schools are closed, don't go when there's tourists. I often go in October and you get really nice.
You're saying there's about 3 days of the year. But that can happen.
Yeah, but it's also funny. Sometimes you can take photos and you get this beautiful blue water, but it's actually still pretty cold and no one's swimming in it. But I love Scotland. I've been there to watch rugby lots, and luckily I've done a few green landing trips there. And not green landing, but just off-roading. I think Martin said the Land Rover's launching the Octa there for local journalists soon, so he'll go up there. Scotland's a very special place. And yeah, you can have incredible adventures in the UK, definitely.
So let's just before we move on, well, let us hear a message from our sponsors.
We're proud to partner with Adrian Flux, an insurance broker that specialises in covering all types of Land Rovers, including classic, ex-military, modified and Q-plated models. Adrian Flux offers a range of optional extras to make the policy your own and can provide cover for off-roading, green laning, agreed value and build-up cover. Plus, they even offer a discount of up to 15% for Owners Club members. Simply search Adrian Flux Land Rover Insurance for more information or call them directly on 0344 728 0417 for a quote.
Awesome. Right, so that's the North Coast 500. So you'd highly recommend the North Coast 500 for anybody. I've never done it, you know. I've been to the Isle of Skye, but I've never been to North Coast 500. Long way to go in a TD590.
It is. I am all flying to Inverness, rent a, there's a few companies that rent Land Rovers out there. Rent a, you don't need a four-wheel drive, but it's nice going in a sort of Freelander, Discovery, Defender. Just looks right in that setting in Scotland. So I've sent a few friends out that way, and you just fly in and get a vehicle. It's probably, if you don't have the time, definitely.
Do you have a friend up there that you should do some photography for us? Does he still run a centre?
Greg Dutton, he rents out a few cars. He's got a, I think he's also got a D4 that he rents out there, but then there's also Wild Tracks. They also rent out Defenders. So there's a few companies, and there's some that rent out non-Land Rovers, sort of Hiluxes and Navaras and
okay,
that sort of thing. So if you wanted to rent a vehicle up there, you could. But it's quite been, obviously you say in a TD5 or 300 TDI.
The journey there is quite laborious, especially from, you know, us being in the East Midlands.
And years ago, I went to do a story there and I took from Euston Station, I took the overnight sleeper train to Inverness and picked up a D4 there. I love trains, so, but the sleeper train's not cheap. So you've got to book that well in advance. But that's another way to get up there. Yeah.
One of the things I've always known about you, Pat, is that adventure is not far away. So a lot of people think they have to drive to the other side of the world to get an adventure. But you'd have adventures on the way home from work.
I know, yeah.
You camp in random places and you run home and...
Yeah, it's just often the paddle boards in the back of the car, there's always a barbecue or a fridge or there's something in it and you can just... We're lucky to live where we do and even yourself. So I've always been close to the River Ouse or the River Nen at the moment. I'm living in Northampton now. But I love going paddling on the river. I mean, Dave Phillips always used to rave about the river and I didn't understand it until I started paddling on it. So I definitely agree with him. The River Nen is a special place. But when we worked at the old, with the Bedford office, I think when Chris left, we went and had that barbecue next to the Ouse.
Down the River Ouse,
he's farewell, but that's it. And Falmersham, but I go paddling there all the time. And then I've got a few secret spots that I don't really tell people about. Where we go and wild camp close to our homes. You know, you don't want to drive a long way, but you want to go and camp and make a fire. And
yeah,
so I do have those, and they will exist where other people live too. You just got to go out there. It's normally just a random conversation. For example, at Falmersham, I was chatting to a guy at the bridge there, and because sometimes it gets busy there and it's really hot, and he told me about another little secret place, and now we go and camp there. So and it's a public road that basically runs into, finishes next to a river, and there's grass and big trees, and we've camped there so many times, and the locals know we go there, and they know we leave the place clean, and we're respectful of the environment. That's the most important thing.
Getting
the confidence of the locals and the trust of the locals. They even come sometimes to sit with us and we tell stories around the fire. So
yeah. You will never ever get that. Yeah, you will never do it again, will you? Never eat that.
But the one thing I find like really hard in the UK is a lot of the land here is private, and even when we go green laning in the Lake District, a lot of people are so abusive towards us. I didn't like that at all. You know,
there is a lot of pressure on the same part of the ground. Yeah. So green laning is quite a contentious subject.
Yeah, it is, and it's such a wonderful way to see some places. And not everyone can hike over these mountains. You and I are still lucky. We fit enough. We can.
Well, you definitely me. Let's see.
We can.
Yeah.
We can climb over these mountains. Yeah.
So going back, you were in the South African Army.
Yeah.
Did they have Land Rovers?
Yeah, so we did. It's interesting. We used to call them Garys. I don't know where the nickname came from, but we used to call Land Rovers Garys.
G-A-R-Y. Gary.
I'd love to know where that comes from. So we did, and I was nearly killed in one. once.
Oh, okay.
I was deployed in, so South Africa ran Namibia for a while before they had the elections in sort of 89, and then we held onto Walvis Bay, a small enclave with a bunker and an Air Force base and an Army base. And I was based there for several months. And one night I think we'd been at a beer festival or something of that nature. And I needed to get a lift back to the base from one of the other lieutenants. And we were in a Defender. And we ended up having quite a serious crash on the road to Windhoek. And they had to, on the road to Swakopmund. And they had to cut the Defender out from under the truck. And I literally had to kick the side window out. My head smashed the windscreen.
Oh.
I say that's why I don't even hear it. But
yeah.
I've still got the scar.
It was working with me that made you lose your hair.
Yeah, so, and then I've still got the newspaper article where it says three Defence Force members have miraculously escaped death. There's actually four of us in the car. The article was inaccurate, but sadly, the vehicle had just been restored and fixed up and then got written off by us on a Saturday morning or Sunday morning.
You were really lucky.
3 a.m. So we're very, if we were in another vehicle, it could have been decapitated or it could have had a worse ending. But touch wood, on most of my Land Rover trips, all of them, we've had really good luck, except, I mean, the last time we went to Africa with Captain Ratty and Stan, we had a serious incident. I was driving a new Defender 110. We also had a 130, an old one, which were all kitted out with expedition gear and stuff. And it's one of those things where you always tell yourself, don't drive at night in Africa, but then you're trying to push and it's 9 o'clock and you're still on the road. And we're just about to go back onto the N1, which is like the M1 in the UK, where there's well lit and controlled, and a truck driver fell asleep and he came across to me, and I was in the front with the new 110, and next thing this guy's right in front of me, and I literally just hard lock left off the road into the bushes, and the 130 behind me saw this luckily and they followed me. It was so close to a head-on collision, but that you hear all these stories about Defenders rolling, but that new Defender 110, that day I kissed the thing. I was so happy the way it's
safety.
Luckily, there was no one next to the road. We just were able to plow through the bushes and go back onto the road.
No damage for the one car?
Nothing. No damage for both vehicles. The 130 didn't roll. Even though it's top heavy, it had a lot of gear on the roof. So yeah, that was... But when you're traveling in some funny places like the Congo or Rwanda or Angola, you see some mad stuff on the road. So really, really mad stuff. Like, yeah.
So where's next? Where are you traveling to next? So that, obviously, for those who don't know, so Pat, you're now working for Front Runner.
Yeah, so Front Runner, they make expedition gear, primarily a roof rack company. 25 years old this year, and I mean, I've been using their products for as long as I've been a four wheel drive journalist, and I'm a copywriter for them. So, but I don't travel as much as I used to. So I always joke, I say I might be earning more money as a journalist, but I'm not as happy, but I'm not traveling as much. So I'm behind a desk and I'm writing. All day. So, but where to next? So I've booked a flight to South Africa. I go back as often as I can. I was in Australia in December for Christmas, but I'm going to the Kruger National Park, which is the biggest national park in South Africa, in April for the Easter holiday. I'm going for a few weeks, but I'm taking my son and my daughter, and Brooke's coming with. We're all going on safari for a week, and Stan, another mate of mine, is coming with his family. So I've arranged a four-wheel drive there. It's not a Land Rover. And we're going to go and stay in the park for a week because my son loves animals. And it's a story I did a few times for magazines. I've been in that park so many times. But to take people who are dear to me there and to go show them what it's like in there.
And to not work.
Yeah.
Not have the responsibility of getting the perfect shot or writing the perfect words.
Yeah, there's none of that, yeah.
Yeah.
So it's exciting, yeah. And then... we might head down to Cape Town as well for a few days, and yeah, so it's exciting. I do go back to Africa as much as I can. Yeah.
Okay, so I'm going backwards and forwards here. So you had the bow accident in the Land Rover in the army.
Yeah.
Is that the scariest time you've had Land Rover?
Yeah. So people ask, like, what is the most nerve wracking thing you've ever done? Then I've driven around in those new Defenders, which in the Bond movie, I was lucky I got to drive one of those at a press event and with stunt driving coordinator, and that's nuts. You just balls to the wall, going sideways, and that's lovely. But my scariest moment, Land Rover moment, was the last day of Defender production. So, sell.
Well, we were there, weren't we? Me, yeah. Why was I? Oh, yeah. I know what you're going to say now.
Yeah, yeah. I managed to get you an invite to that. It was a very, very special day. And 3-4 in the morning, we were driving up to Solihull and doing live interviews on BBC radio. But while there, watching The Last Defender roll off the production line, hundreds of people, just chaos. I get a phone call from Sky News. Can we interview you? And back then, I was still trying to fit into the British culture. I had a barber jacket and a flat cap.
Yeah, you did go through a farmer look, didn't you? I've still got my farmer look, but
I have moved on from that. But
it was a good look, Pat. You know,
aunt even bought me a flat cap. But
day though, you don't realise how special it was until after you left.
Yeah.
You were there at the last. Yeah,
and the people that were there. Yes. Yeah, so then I get this call from Sky, and I had to run to the main gate of Land Rover at Solihull, and there's a guy waiting for me there with cameras all set up, and then next minute, live across to Patrick Kreivach, and they can't pronounce my surname.
I can't. Okay.
And I can hear the lady in the studio, and then 3 minutes, 2.5 minutes, talking to me live around the world, Sky News. I can't remember a word I said. I haven't watched the interview.
I have. I haven't seen it for a while, but you did remarkably well, because they asked you questions. They kind of assumed that you knew the financial situation or position of Land Rover, didn't they? I don't think they quite worked out that you were from an enthusiast magazine. And they, we've got Patrick here, editor of Land Rover Monthly. Kind of like, hang on a minute. They were asking you like their financial position at Land Rover. They're like, but you answered them really well, the questions. Is it on YouTube?
I think it's on my Instagram if you scroll through there. And like a few days ago was obviously the commemoration of last day, and people like Greg King and Nick Dunmore, those sort of Land Rover enthusiasts, they were posting stuff from that day. But yeah.
9 years ago.
I know. Yeah. I can't believe it. A decade. That's nuts.
Right.
And that's the great thing about Defenders, is there still so many of them around that look brand new and that look wonderful.
Yeah. Because we always worried that at that point, you know, it's the end. It's the end of what we know as a magazine. Yeah. But actually, it isn't.
Anything. It
was the start.
Yeah. And it's helped the magazines to grow a little bit, really. Yeah. Talking about Defenders, you probably need to speak about your 90.
Which one? Oh, you have listened to the previous podcast where you know that Martin asks me. Well, what's good, right? So we're not recording this in time, as people will know. So we know that when you're listening to this, the engine will have gone in by 90 10 days ago without a problem. It's just going to go straight in. So is the gearbox, so is the transfer box.
Yeah. I just remember coming to your house and seeing that. And
it's exactly
all the hard work you put in at times. And then obviously it just stalled, which is not a bad thing, because you're obviously very busy at the magazine. There's lots going on with all the events. I think the most pleasing thing for me 2 years on from leaving the magazine is seeing how well it's doing and how it's reinvented itself with the podcast, with the events, because you and I both know media has changed out of sight. That's really a pleasing aspect of it all.
It is. I mean, recording podcasts, editing podcasts, the video that we're now doing on YouTube, that's almost, if we're being honest with ourselves, that's a full-time job in itself.
Yeah.
And that sounds, yeah, really, but it actually does take up a lot of our time. The events is another full-time job.
Yeah.
I don't know how, what did we do with our spare time when we just had a magazine?
Yeah.
You know, we've got the website, we've got email databases,
Facebook, Instagram.
All of these different, you know, all these plates to spin has evolved. But let's be honest. I'm not complaining. We're very, very lucky. You know, and I pinch myself some days. I pinch myself because we are actually doing a job that we're passionate about.
Yeah, yeah.
And we get to talk about Land Rovers.
I know,
for a job.
I know.
I mean, we are lucky.
If your passion can be your work and it makes you happy, and that's definitely something I did while at SA 4x4, and definitely at Land Rover Monthly. And it was nice because, as you said, there were these budgets I could fly to Malaysia or wherever and go and join.
Yeah.
Go and join expeditions for a week or two, or just disappear. And I often went back to Africa to go and do lots of features there with Kingsley Holgate. I went to Ethiopia.
Yeah, yeah.
So I was just very fortunate to be in that position.
Because we had like the budgets at the time where if you didn't use it, you would lose it. A bit like the local councils, when they, if they don't use the budget, they lose it.
Yeah.
So you were Yeah, we had free, you had free reign, didn't you, pretty much?
And also because we were one of the smaller mags in the whole Dennis Publishing stable, but people just, as long as we were making money and doing okay, they just sort of left us alone. Obviously, Jeff Love sort of kept it.
Yeah, our original publisher.
And Dave kept an eye on things, but yeah, that we were lucky to go out and do all those incredible things.
Yeah, no, good times. So for our audience then, so getting into preparing vehicles, we often see, you know, vehicles completely loaded up with kit. Now you work for Frontrunner, so part of what Frontrunner want to do is kit cars out with lots of stuff. What are your top? So you've got a standard Land Rover, you want to do a bit of local camping adventure, what are you going to fit to your car?
I wouldn't just throw money in and put a bull bar on and a rack on and buy a Alucab or Frontrunner tent. I wouldn't do that straight away. I would just do short little local trips and find out, do I actually like camping?
Yeah, lots of people don't.
Is this for me? Because I have seen so many people, well, you go to Nien Overland and he's built this amazing vehicle for this guy. The guy goes for 2 weeks in it and says, this is not for me. You know?
Yeah, the wife doesn't like it, yeah, or vice versa.
And keep it simple. Just buy a little ground tent, take along a little cooler box. It doesn't have to be the top end stuff, but first make sure that you this overlanding thing or camping thing is for you. So I would, or just rent, go to Scotland, like I said earlier, fly into Inverness, go and do North Coast 500 and camp in a fully kitted vehicle. Those vehicles have got everything you need. They've got duvets in them, they've got fridges in them, they've got cutlery sets, and just find out, is that for me? That would be my first tip. But then if you've decided is for you, then you can start kitting out your Land Rover.
Yeah, I think from my own perspective, I mean, I've got your old Frontrunner tent, because you got a new one when you joined Frontrunner, didn't you? Pretty much.
Yeah.
And I mean, that's years old, isn't it?
Yeah.
Still as good as new.
Yeah.
It's a bit faded. You know, they fade, don't they, when they've been in the sunlight for so long. But I've stuck that on my camping trailer now, because you were driving around with this massive box on the top of your Land Rover. So you were kind of like not benefiting from the perfect handling of your Land Rover because you've got this huge weight on top.
Keep the weight down. That's the number one rule of overlanding. When you go and do a desert trip in Namibia, like Ludwig's Wolfish Bay, you're driving these massive sand dunes. I did it once in a TD5 Defender, brand new, double cab Defender, and there was just 20 Land Cruisers with me on the trip. Yeah. So just imagine the immense pressure on you.
You needed to make sure that came home. Yeah.
So I had two other journalists with me on the trip, two ladies, and we just stayed in ground tents and took a lot of water with, but all the weight was really kept low because you can't drive those big sand dunes. You'll literally flip over. So keep the weight low. People are just so quick to buy a lot of gear, and I like to keep it simple. I really do. It's nice to have things that work. It's nice to have
showers and
solar panels. Yeah. So when you go, like, because we've been doing this for so long, we know like what is a good shower and what you need to have a good shower. So my mate Stan, on his 90, he's got a lovely gas shower, and we always just, he just puts up the shower room on the side of his 90, and we all just use that. So everyone doesn't have, don't duplicate things. So if there's three or four of you going, it's silly to have four sets of Max Trucks with you. You know, you just need two.
Yeah, of course.
So talk to each other beforehand and plan your expedition and make sure you're not taking along too much stuff, man. So because often I would get press vehicles, you can't have too much stuff because you're getting a standard Land Rover. So you just do the basics and do it right. For me, priority is I want a car good. I do.
Hold my dear.
Yeah. I make sure the car has got a fridge in it. Because, yeah,
number one.
Yeah, and I want meat in there so I can barbecue. So I just want a fridge. I want something that I can cook on. And say what you like. I know South Africans are, gas is not real braaiing or barbecuing. I don't give a hoot. When my mates come here and they see my little KDAC Safari Chef, they want one as well. And they have that in there. Because you can stop while you're green laning. Often when we go green laning in the UK, I'll stop at lunchtime and I've got the sausages are sizzling in like 2 minutes. And you can have a little barbecue during a lunchtime stop while green laning. And people remember that. Remember the time we put the awning up, it was raining, and with underneath it having nice sausage baps instead of a bloody meal deal from Sainsbury's. That's much.
You are 100%. Because, yeah, I've converted to gas, I have to say, because the faff. And you have to wait for it to cool down, and you've got all this ash.
Yeah.
It goes in the back of your Land Rover, and the ash comes out.
Yeah.
and you've got the charcoal and you've got to get it going. Gas is kind of, I am a convert.
Yeah.
No, to be fair, you still get a barbecue taste. Yeah. You still get quite as charcoal, I believe it. You do.
But we love an open fire. So, I mean, we have fun. We've got a log burner in our house, and I even import the wood from Namibia. So it's hardwood, it's heavy. So even the next morning when you wake up, you go down to the lounge, you can still see the red glow of ember. So we often have an open fire when we go camping. If you go to a Billings show, there's nothing like sitting around an open fire with your mate. So there's a place for both of them.
No, definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah. So keep the weight low. Don't spend out on all the equipment.
No. As you go along, figure it out. Go to overland events or camping shows or billing, and just walk around, chat to people, see what they've got, learn from your friends. Yeah, but initially, I would say just keep it simple, and then figure it out for yourself. Yeah.
So, your time at Frontrunner, you're doing a lot, you're interviewing lots of people, and you're writing lots of content across all manner of 4x4. How are you seeing that, like, the Land Rover scene in comparison to the other 4x4 scene?
So my, now it's more sort of focused on overland, because we make overland gear, but because we're owned by Dometic, I mean, Dometic have got Dometic Marine, Dometic Refrigeration. It's a massive, massive company. We do, like, you know, like Yeti, we've got our own brand. It's very similar to Yeti. So we do for camper vans, fans. The van market is growing massively, in especially in Europe. So how do I perceive the Land Rover? It's interesting. So we had a guy recently, David Stecker. He's got a classic Range Rover that he's kitted out. It's got our rack on and it's got our tent on, but he just loves beautiful old classic things, and they don't get much better than a classic Range Rover. So there's a lot of guys using Defenders still for overlanding. It's still a very popular vehicle, because for a lot of people around the world, it's the first vehicle they ever saw. So I think you'll never lose that. You'll never lose the fact that it's, I mean, you can get into a Jeep or a Hilux. It's, there's no way, it's not as iconic. I'll give you, it's so funny how different the markets are. So I just spent 2 weeks in Australia. I saw two Defenders in 2 weeks. Two old Defenders.
Yeah, yeah. Matt, it's a different, myself and Martin were talking that we look at a lot of YouTube stuff in Australia, because they seem to have some really good adventures.
Yeah, I was in Brisbane, which is where one of your contributors lives, Jack.
Oh, yeah, Jack Dobson, yeah.
I saw one Defender in Brisbane, one old Defender. I saw a lot of new Defenders, saw a lot of Range Rovers, saw one classic Range Rover. But yeah, so the markets are so different. Whereas in the UK, you guys would be so careful with your Defenders getting stolen, yeah, because people realize what they're worth now. But in South Africa, people will never steal a Defender, because they think, no,
what did I steal?
I'm stealing problems. Hiluxes, Land Cruisers.
They're stealing problems, like that.
Yeah, they are. You're stealing someone else's problem.
So I've owned a few Land Rovers in the past. You think, I wish someone would steal this. That was my misery, but no, you should never wish that on anybody.
The only thing they will steal, and when I still lived there, was sometimes I'd get into my Defender, because I owned an apartment in, like, looking out over the sea, and it was in Camps Bay. Or a Camps Bay Sea Point, but I parked on the street, and there was a security guard from the Congo, but sometimes, I don't know, it's quite busy, but against my car started, and I know I've just filled it up with petrol, and it doesn't start, and I'm like, what's broken now? And then you go and climb underneath and look at the tank, someone's put a hole in the tank.
Oh, really?
That happened twice to me. So they won't steal a Defender, but they want the fuel's worth more than the Defender.
Especially when you were like your 2.8, your fuel tank.
Especially if you just fold it, yeah.
Yeah.
So that happened, you know.
While I remember, we need to give a bit of a shout out. So we have a younger listener who likes to listen to the podcast when he's going to sleep. So I don't know if it is my voice or Martin's voice that sends him to sleep, but Max Bray, if you're listening, it's long past your bedtime. Stop spending your dad's money, because that's what you're doing. He thinks that everything we say is absolutely gospel. And he tells his dad to spend money on his Land Rover. So a bit of a shout out to Max.
Well, Max, my son is the same age as you, buddy. He also loves Land Rovers. And he is very sad when I sold my Defender. So maybe the two of you will meet at LRM Live or at some Land Rover show one day. Two young Land Rover enthusiasts. And I hope you enjoyed this podcast, buddy.
Yeah, exactly. I reckon, did Pat send you to sleep or was it me? I wonder how many more people we actually send to sleep. But no, Yeah, I think we've pretty much covered. I wrote a few notes. Some of it I can't repeat. You know, we've got some stories, haven't we?
Yeah.
We possibly couldn't use a podcast to talk about. But some of the best stories come out after the podcast.
We'll save those for part two in a year.
Yeah, we need to do part two. Around the campfire with a beer, because I think that's the...
Definitely.
It's a scene, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's nice. We're getting towards the end of the British winter, so there are definitely some events coming up. I'm off to the NEC next week. It's the big camping show.
No, of course, yeah.
But I'm looking forward to LRM Live this year. Hopefully I can get there. But yeah, the shows are definitely thin on the ground in the UK, except for your guys' events. I'm not going to go to the LRO show. Of course.
We went to the LRA show last September at Beaver Castle, for those who don't know. Every show is kind of different now.
Yeah.
We have our big 2-day show in May, 17th, 18th of May, if you don't already know. Obviously, Pat, but our listeners might not.
Yeah. So,
set in the Malvern Hills, it's absolutely stunning backdrop.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's a proper showground, you know. So if it rains or if it's sunny, it doesn't matter. You've got nice... You call them tar roads, but they're tarmac roads or concrete roads. And then you've got a proper camping set up. And it's just a lovely place. And our show is very different to the LRO show.
Yeah.
As is Billing, you know, the Billing Off-Road show. We've both been there, going there for years.
Right. I know.
Yeah. Every year you go, I might rest it. I might not go next year. And then every year comes around. And
you always go.
You always go.
It's so funny you say that. Yeah, I swore I wouldn't go last year. Then a friend flew over from South Africa just to go to the Billing show, traveled a long way.
Yeah.
And then there you are again. Yeah. But I love Sarah and Richard. They're friends. And I used to live pretty close to there. Still live.
You still do, really, don't you?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I go.
You could paddle down the river sort of, couldn't you?
I could. I sometimes go running and I run past their farm. So, it's... I probably won't be filling this.
Yeah, no, we should sit around the campfire. Bring a campfire and some meat and we'll have a barbecue.
Good. I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah. Anyone that wants to, if you're there, yeah, I'm sure you'll be hanging around the LRM tent as well.
I always come and say hello, yeah.
And you've got some articles lined up for us as well, I think?
Yeah, I'm doing a few. We've got a very interesting, one of our ambassadors, TA Outdoors, 2.5 million followers on YouTube.
Almost as many as us.
Nearly. He's catching you, PK. He's a bushcraft expert.
Okay.
I'm interviewing him soon. So, yeah, there are a few bits that I love to still be involved in the magazine. And I'll always be an LRM fan. And I'll always be involved in the magazine in some capacity. Yeah.
Nice. Well, until then, it's been a pleasure.
Thanks, Stevie. I always love seeing you, my friend.
Yeah, it's been too long. And we must catch up soon. But thanks to all our listeners. And we'll no doubt join you again in the near future. And we'll hear from you next week, or hear from us next week, so I say.
Yeah.
Bye for now.
Thanks, Steve. Cheers, buddy.